In class, we've been talking about Old Testament, how that relates to our Christian lives today. And last week, we started with the book of Exodus, and we covered the first half of the book of Exodus about God using Moses to free his people, coming through the Red Sea, wandering in the wilderness, and really talked about messages of salvation, deliverance. Those were some of the major themes. Moses as a leader of the people, and how that also tied a lot to Jesus. And we're trying to find Jesus Christ in the Old Testament. So today what we're going to do is look at the back half of the book of Exodus. And specifically, we're going to talk about the tabernacle and what the purpose was for the tabernacle, some of the things that were in it, how those tie to our worship today, and what is still relevant. So, the tabernacle, or the tent of meeting, does anybody know what the word tabernacle means? Tent? Close. It means to dwell with. Tabernacle means to dwell with. And so, we got into this just briefly last week. When we say dwell with, who are we talking about? Who's going to dwell with?
God.
Yeah, God the Father decided that He was going to dwell with His people. How is that different than the first 2,000 years that the earth was in existence after God created it? Why now? And what do you think the purpose was of God deciding that He wanted to dwell in a temporary tabernacle?
Well, he chose a people, and He chose them to make a great nation out of them, and so He wanted to be with them at times on earth, and He was with them when they were obedient, and when they were not obedient, He did not dwell with them on earth.
Okay.
Well, could it be the same reason He gave them the law was to keep them in check until the promise could be fulfilled?
Okay. How was His dwelling with them in the tabernacle different than how He dwelt with them in Adam and Eve's time, or when He was with Abraham? How is it different?
It was a separation.
Okay. So when God dwelt with Adam and Eve in the garden, there was an intimate relationship where He would speak with them and know them, and then because of their sin, there was a separation out of the garden. So we're still going to have some separation there, but it's a very physical. You can definitely see and memorialize the separation that's there. Any other thoughts about, you know, why God decided to dwell with His people in this fashion?
Well, some of it, I mean, with the tabernacle is to establish a pattern that could be used for the temple. And I think part of class is to establish that there's a pattern for today.
Okay. Okay, well, I would agree with that. That was one of the thoughts that I was having too, is to really set down and lay down a pattern of worship that God wanted His people to follow. Now, that worship would change a little bit, but in principle and concept, many of the things that God laid down in the Ten Commandments, in Deuteronomy and Leviticus, and what we see in the worship through the tabernacle, still remain today in those principles. Before we kind of get into the tabernacle a little bit more, wanted to ask the question of our group, how do we meet with God today? So if they had a tabernacle that God came and dwelt with them, how is it that we meet or dwell with God today?
Well, we have a mediator, which is Christ.
Okay.
We have communion with God when we observe the Lord's table. We can communicate with Him about any time we want to through prayer, like Clayton said. And then our body is the temple of God, which the temple took the place of the tabernacle in the Old Testament, so God is to dwell in our temple.
Will somebody read 1 Corinthians 6:19? Got a couple passages here.
body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, and you have from God, and you are not your own.
Okay, so very clearly, Ben said it established a pattern of worship, and that is where God dwelt and worshiped with His people. Today, what is the tabernacle of God according to 1 Corinthians 6:19?
Our bodies
are the temple. Okay? Ephesians chapter 3, Paul says this, I pray that out of His glorious riches He may strengthen you with power through His Spirit in your inner man, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts. Again, our temple, God is going to dwell within us. Another passage we can put down is 1 Corinthians chapter 3, where Paul says this, do you not know that you yourself are God's temple and that God's Spirit lives in you? And when he says that, it's plural. I think he's also saying that not only does God dwell within each of us individually, but God also dwells with us corporately and as a body as we come together. Jesus said, when two or three are gathered, there I am in their midst, in Matthew chapter 18. So just a couple, three passages about where does God dwell today compared to where He dwelt with them in the wanderings through the wilderness. Knowing that there were a lot of strict rules and regulations about how God dwelt and how He wanted acceptable worship back then in the tabernacle system, is there anything that we could or should do differently today in our worship to make sure that we are reverencing and showing the great significance of the ability to meet with God? Is there anything that we could or should do differently today to really underscore just the awesome power and the significance of being in the presence of a holy God?
Well, we know our worship is supposed to be orderly fashion. That's one thing.
Okay. Do we need to wear a white linen robe and have it washed a certain way and then, you know, bathe and all kinds of these other things?
No, but we need to make sure that we keep it, it can be simple, but we need to make sure that we hold in reverence that, you know, God gives us this ability to worship Him through His Word, so we need to make sure that we take advantage of that.
Okay.
You know, we're told in Scripture not to forsake the assembly. That way we have that communion with Him.
So kind of two things. As I mentioned, God dwells in us individually and He dwells with us corporately as a body, as His church. There's things that we need to do to maintain and keep up our body, which is the temple, but also to keep and maintain the church that Christ has established. There's things that God wants done. So we're going to look at some of those patterns and some of those things that God said, I want you to do this and organize the temple a certain way that are going to be relevant today. Okay.
I think another thing about that is he was very laid out and distinctive in how he wanted the tabernacle done. We have a little more freedom in how we worship today, but we still need to go with the biblical example that we have because that's all we have to go by.
Okay. So in its general construct, you know, we've got this long, I think it's 75 by 150 are the dimensions of the tabernacle. It's roughly the size of about half of a football field in size. What was the perimeter?
Tents.
What?
Like panels.
Panels, yeah. So these tall linen white panels that hung on rings that went all the way around. And what was around the outside perimeter of the tabernacle? I'll give you a hint. And it's not a clock. The 12 tribes, they circled around the tabernacle of meeting. How many entrances were there to where God dwelt?
Just one.
Just one. And I guess I'm not quite sure I'm oriented, but let's just say that this is west, and this is going to be east. The door always faced east, and there was only one entrance into the courtyard. How is that significant or important?
Into the church.
That's right. So if this is where God meets and dwells with His people, there's only one access point. So what are some passages in the New Testament that kind of carry out this principle?
John 14 and 6.
Okay, go ahead, Ben, if you got that memorized.
I am the way, the truth, the life, no one comes to the Father except through me.
Okay. So when you come into this courtyard, what is the first thing that you see once you enter the access through Christ? Remember, James said it's got a very prescribed layout and form and fashion, and God does that for a reason. So as you walk through this one entrance, what is the first thing that's in front of you?
The
No.
Well, you've got the laver, the altar. It's called the sea of bronze. That's the...
altar is the first thing. Yeah. The bronze sea or the bronze laver is the next. So the altar is the first thing you see. Okay, what's the purpose of the altar? Okay. So if I know that the only way to have access to God is to come in through Jesus, the first way that I have that access is because He did what? He sacrificed for us. So there's the immediate reminder right in front of our nose that the only way that I'm able to have access to God is because Jesus sacrificed Himself for me. No different than the Old Testament. If you want to come in, you got to sacrifice these animals. After you sacrifice, so God has done something for us. You know, He made the way, He gave the sacrifice, He took the first step because He first loved us. Now what do we have to do? What's the next thing that comes in?
So you have to sacrifice, you have to give up your old life for the new, and then the labor would represent baptism or worship.
Yeah, the water is the next thing that we see. God makes that first move, reaches out, He loves us, He sacrifices His Son for us. But then He says, there's something that you need to do. You need to get yourself clean. You know, they came and they used that to wash their hands, their feet, to prepare themselves before they went in to the holy place. We have to do the same. God asks that we wash away our sins. We clean up our lives. But that's after the sacrifice has been made. Okay, what's after that?
You got the holy place, and then you got the most holy place.
Yeah.
I think there was a wall, when there was a wall all the way across between the courtyard and the holy place. I'm not sure.
Between here?
Well, I mean from side to side, up, no. Between the labor.
Oh.
Yeah, all the way across. Wasn't there a canvas wall here?
I don't know if there was or not.
And then the holy place, and then it was divided off from the most holy place.
Correct. We'll just call this MHP and the HP. What's in the holy place? So you come into the holy place, and what's in there?
Candlestick.
Okay, a candlestick. So, and was it candles? What was it? Was it a wax candle? Was it a... And what was it made out of?
Gold.
Solid or plated?
Solid
gold. Most everything else was plated with gold, but the candlestick was solid gold. How much did it weigh? 75 pounds of solid gold. And it contained these... meant to look like an almond bud and blossoms, and they had these little leaflets at the top for each of them. You know, we know the term of menorah, but it held a little bit of that olive oil in a wick at the top. And so, what's the purpose of having this candlestick?
It was the only source of light in the
pulpit. Okay, the only source of light. Okay. That comes into some of our New Testament. What does Jesus say?
I am the way, the truth, and the life.
Okay, way, truth, and light, life as well. I am the light of the world. Did that light ever go out? No. And whose responsibility was it to make sure those lights did not go out? Who was the first one? Aaron. Yeah, Aaron and his sons... were the ones that were responsible. More than one person could go into the holy place, and those Levitical priests had to come in and they had to make sure that light never went out. If that light wasn't burning, it was a dark place. Again, this is Jesus. The world was dark without Him, and He brought the light to it. What else was in that holy place?
altar of incense.
Okay, we got this altar of incense right here. And Eddie, what do we know about that altar of incense? It did, yeah. On each of the four corners, it had these horns, and that's where the priest would put some of the blood from their sacrifices there. What else do we know about the altar of incense?
It was gold.
Yes. It also was gold. I think I may have had some. What took place on the altar of incense?
Doesn't that represent prayers?
It does. Eddie, do you want to... we could read a couple passages here. Revelation chapter 8, verses 3 and 4, if you want to read that. Revelation 8, 3 and 4. How often was that incense supposed to be burning? Continuously. Ben, actually, let's have somebody else read 1 Thessalonians 5:17 to talk about the burning of the incense, and then Eddie's going to read about what the incense represents.
What verse is that in 8?
3 and 4.
Or 8, 3 and 4?
Yes.
And another angel, having a golden censer, came and stood at the altar. He was given much incense that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne.
Okay, and then the 1 Thessalonians 5:17.
Pray without ceasing. Pray without ceasing.
Pray without. That's how often we're to be giving our incense. What else did we have in the holy place?
Bread.
Okay, it had a name. The table of showbread. I think it was kind of over here on this side. And how much showbread was on the table?
Roughly 150 pounds.
Oh, okay. I didn't remember the pounds, but that
I thought that
may be right. There was a certain number of loaves.
Wasn't there a loaf for each tribe?
There was. There was
just
12
like there
loaves.
Was a candlestick for each tribe.
Correct. I don't know if there was a candlestick for each tribe. I don't think there were that many, were there? Okay. Yeah, so we have this loaf right in here, 12 of them. And what James is saying is that it may have weighed up to 150 pounds.
I thought that's what. And I don't like, I've got a diagram of the tabernacle in my,
oh, okay,
my note thing. And actually the table of showbread and the lampstand are flipped in it, but I don't know. But it shows 7 candles on the candle.
Okay. I can't remember. I don't know if it tells us. I think it does, or if that's just tradition that the Jews have had a certain amount.
Maybe we can dig into that a little bit more.
Okay, so table of showbread, what is that representing? That's a pretty easy one that we see today, right? Yeah, we know that immediate access to the presence of God comes in the sacrifice of Christ's body. He sustains us. He fills us. I am the bread of life. So then we come into the most holy place, which is a perfect cube. I think it's, I can't remember if it's 15 cubits or 15 feet once you convert it. But it's a box. Height, width, length. And what do we find in the most holy place? Actually, what's between the holy place and the most holy place? Okay, the veil. We'll talk about that a little bit more as we come here. Because that's a critical element for today as well. But what's in the holy place, most holy place?
Ark of the Covenant.
Okay, so we got this Ark of the Covenant that's there. On top of it, we have the two cherub that are facing each other with their wings outspread. And it's got a covering lid, the atonement or the mercy seat, which above it God dwells. And inside of the Ark of the Covenant, what do we have?
Aaron's rod
that blossoms, the manna that they, and the showbread, kind of the manna, okay? The Ten Commandments. All right, so we got a few things that are contained in that
Ark of the Covenant.
The mercy seat, which covers the top of it, solid gold. All right.
And so,
how often did the high priest access the most holy place?
Once a year.
Once a year, the day that the Jews today call Yom Kippur. That's their Day of Atonement,
as many people refer to it.
That's the one day out of the year that only the high priest gets to come in behind the veil and make the sacrifice. And what else happened on that Day of Atonement? The priest would come in and he would wash thoroughly. They would take a goat, I believe, and they would release it out into the wilderness, never to be found again, that represented the sins that went away. And then they would sacrifice another animal, and he would go in, and he would sprinkle the blood on the mercy seat and everything else. How did we know, and how did the, I guess I'd say, how did the children of Israel know that God was there at that very moment? What kind of visual indication did they have?
It was filled with smoke.
Yeah, this whole thing was just filled with smoke. And how did they know that they needed to move the tabernacle from one location to another?
The smoke moved.
The pillar moved as well. Was there any light in the most holy place?
Well, there was when God was there, because like you said, it was smoke, but I don't think it wasn't smoke. It was like it was a bright type of a fog. It was so bright that they couldn't even be in there. A human being couldn't be in there, like when Solomon dedicated the temple. That was, of course, took place in the tabernacle. It was so bright when God came down that a human being couldn't even stand to be in there.
I don't know how bright it was, but that is what I understand as well, is that there was no light in that room, but the glory of God and God's presence was that light that emanated from right above the Ark of the Covenant, right above the mercy seat. What a fascinating thing it must have been for the holy priest, the high priest, to be able to go in and see that. The reverence, all of the sacrificing, everything leading up to that one day. You know, only one person, think of how many children of Israel never got to even come into this area. If you were a woman, just forget about it. You couldn't even come close to this area. How does that compare to today?
All people have access directly to God through Jesus Christ.
We don't have to stay at a distance from God, our Father, and only certain people, one person can go in once a year to have access to Him. We have this immediate access, and all that was made possible by Jesus Christ. So, as we tie this to some of the New Testament implications, one of the things I think pulls in the Old Testament to the New Testament really well is the veil. And so, we know that God gave Moses instructions about what to put on this veil, how to create it, what it should look like. But did Moses, was he the one that actually did it? Did he whip out a needle and a thread and
silk and,
you know, put all this together? It was
fine linen.
No, there were children of Israel who it seems like God blessed so that they could make these things for
them. Yeah, given by name, Bezalel or something like that, and then another guy whose name that began with an O. I can't remember what's happening. God said, Moses, I want you to do this, but then I'm going to use these two craftsmen and worksmen to kind of oversee the work of building all the tabernacle, engraving all the cherubim on the panels, sewing and making this large curtain. Where did they get the linen?
And that was the exquisite fabric of the day. Fine linen. Where did it come from? How'd you make it? It's from a flax out of the Nile Delta. They got it from the Egyptians. And what color was it? What color was the veil?
Scarlet.
Yeah, it was a dark purple. Anybody want to? I was reading this. And I just found it really fascinating. How did they make it purple?
Well, I think they would dye it. I'm not sure what they made the dye out of, but if it was berries or some kind of blood.
Okay, we got a little sidebar going on here. What does the Morrises say?
Oh, I'm not looking on the internet.
Okay.
I was thinking clams.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So what I read and what most of history says is that it came from a snail, a sea snail. So if you go, it's like a little conch shell about this big. It's called a murex snail, And this particular snail secretes this dark, inky mucus type of a deal. I mean, like a tiny little drop of it. And so in some of these historical writings in the Grecian times, because they used a lot of purple as well, it took about 1,000 of these little snails, these sea snails, to produce one gram of this dye. I mean, you keep them alive, and they could, like, milk these things. It was kind of odd. Or you could just totally crush it and squeeze it out. But, you know, if you could culture them and grow them and keep them alive, you could get more and more of this ink. This was a huge, huge veil. 15 by 15. And the amount of dye that it would take to make something like this was unbelievable. So they packed all this stuff up. They carried it around the wilderness for how long?
40 years.
And then after that, what happened to this veil?
Well, it got set up for until Solomon built the temple, so 100 years.
Yeah, hundreds of years. And then it remained in Solomon's temple for even longer. I don't know exactly what happened to it after that, but the temple was there in Jerusalem until... How long did that veil last? Till the death of Christ. So let's turn to Matthew chapter 27 and look at that same, you know, same exact veil that was made back in the days of Moses. All three of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, talk about the veil. But the one in Matthew was, I found a little bit interesting. Matthew chapter 27... toward the end here, verse 45. So this is Friday, the day that Christ was crucified. And in verse 45 it says, "From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, there was darkness over all the land. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, 'Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani,' which is, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?' Some of those who stood there when they heard this thought, 'He said, this man is calling for Elijah.' Immediately one of them ran, took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed, and offered it to him to drink. The rest said, 'Let him alone, let us see if Elijah will come to save him.' And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. Then, behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from the top to the bottom, and the earth quaked, and the rocks were split, and the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the graves after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. So the centurion and those who were with him guarding Jesus saw the earthquake, the things that happened, and they feared greatly, saying, 'Truly, this was the Son of God.'" So when was it that the temple veil ripped? Because the way that Matthew writes it, I think, is a little confusing, because he's talking about the happenings on Friday immediately when Jesus dies, and then he jumps to, you know, talking about the graves were open, the bodies of the saints. You know, he's going back to Jerusalem into this period. Was it on Friday that the veil ripped?
I think it was.
Okay.
I think your time difference actually splits between verse 51 and 52, because we know that the bodies didn't come up out of the grave until Christ rose first.
That's why I was a little confused with it.
He was the first to rise from dead, never to die again. And then they followed after him.
Mark and Luke make it seem a lot clearer that it did happen on Friday, right when Christ died.
But this passage in Matthew, I think, kind of muddied it a little bit for me. I'm not
100% sure, but I think it's probably immediately when Christ died that it ripped. And Matthew just jumps to... But here's the reason why I think Matthew jumps to this other end, and that is to make sure that we're tying this... When we, you know, we know that Jesus died, why do we reference the veil of the temple? Why do those writers immediately recall that veil from the Old Testament? I agree.
I think
the writers immediately wanted you to think of the significance being fulfilled from the Old Testament of the purpose of the veil, which was to clearly and distinctly separate man from God because of our sin. And that is the problem that Christ's death fixed at that moment in time.
It also meant that the law of Moses was over and done.
Okay.
And that, because that veil kept everyone out of where God was at, by tearing the veil in half, it signified you could go in now.
Other thoughts?
What was it about the veil upon their face? Is that in comparison to that or not?
I didn't see a whole lot. I mean, I think it was to make sure that there was a separation, a physical separation between them and the presence of God. But I had never really put a whole lot between a head veil with the veil of the tabernacle here. All right, so those are the main things that I wanted to cover about the tabernacle, the system of worship. We've just got about 5 minutes left. What thoughts do you have about God setting this form of worship up to talk about how He dwells with His people, patterns for worship, and how those look today? So, when we read in Matthew chapter 27, there was a centurion that was there that when this temple, when the veil was torn, when Christ died, what was the proclamation that he made in verse 54, Matthew 27?
This was the Son of God.
Yeah, so there was a recognition that Jesus was the Son of God by a Gentile, when the separation was taken away, when this veil was torn and pulled away, and there was access between God and His people. When was another time in the New Testament where everybody who was there, when something was open and pulled back, that it was clearly evident that all the around said, "This is the Son of God"? How about the baptism of Jesus? What happened at the baptism of Jesus by John the Baptist? John takes him down into the water, and then what happens?
See, the Holy Spirit descends on him like a dove, and then God spoke and said, "This is my Son, in whom I'm well pleased."
Yeah, the heavens opened. God pulls back that massive curtain, and this dove comes down. God's presence is there, and He speaks and confers with them. And everybody knows when God opens this up, this is the Son of God. Similar thing happened at the death of Christ.
Eric, you know, the ninth chapter of Hebrews really goes along well with the class. We could read the whole thing, but starting there in verse 1, "Indeed, even the first covenant had ordinance of divine service and earthly sanctuary, for a tabernacle was prepared, the first part of which was the lampstand," and goes forth, right? So then, verse 6, "Now when these things had thus prepared, the priest always went into the first part of the tabernacle performing the service, but in the second part, the high priest went alone once a year." So it goes on to explain the process. Then verse 11, "But Christ came as high priest of good things to come with greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, nor with the blood of bulls and goats and calves, but with his own blood he entered the most holy place once for all, having attained eternal redemption." So, you know, that's a good comparison of the tabernacle and the process that they had of the sacrifices. And how it relates to Jesus' sacrifice.
That'd be a good class assignment. Hebrews 9 and even into 10, it continues all the way through there about the tabernacle worship and how Christ is so much better than that system that did serve its purpose in that time, but Christ fulfilled it all in all.
I did find a candlestick. It did have six branches, three on each side. That's in Exodus 37 and 17, and then those branches had a bunch of bowls on the ends of them, so there was all kinds of lights on them. But there was three on each side, not 12.
Okay.
Yeah. Three on each side and one in the middle.
One in the middle, so
seven total.
Yeah. Verse 23 says there were seven lamps.
Okay. While the kids are coming up, we know that when God moved, they packed this whole thing up and moved along.
You know how challenging it is to move if you're camping and setting up a tent, campsite, and taking it down? Imagine this thing. You know, they got everything boxed up, and the children of Israel, you know, there may have been 2 million of them, carried it around. But there was one thing that had to be carried a very special way. That Ark of the Covenant had very strict guidance on how they moved that about back in the Old Testament. Just the reverence and the respect. And so, you know, as we move on to the rest of our service today and we remember the death of Christ,
don't forget
how wonderful a privilege it is that we have to be in the presence of God that we have today. So we'll end the class. Appreciate your comments.